Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Tuesday, June 4th, 2019. Day two of a three-day misery for the residents of London as Donald Trump continues his official state visit. And he just cannot resist. He is meddling in the British race for succession of the Prime Minister. Today he held a news conference with the lame duck Theresa May, made her squirm several times, and he's openly promoting the candidacy of Boris Johnson to replace Theresa May. It's not an election that the public is involved with. This is an internal decision by the leaders of the Conservative Party. And it's curious because, you know, Theresa May has never stood for election. She was handed the stinky baton after the Brexit measure passed, and she was basically internally appointed by the Tories. And so Trump really displaying equal parts of arrogance and ignorance interferes in the political machinations in a country that's already in chaos and politically it's on its knees. And one of the things, as I mentioned, he's been promoting the promoters of Brexit. And so today he held a meeting with Nigel Farage, one of the leaders of the Brexit campaign. And get this, just 2 hours before their meeting, Farage was summoned on Wednesday, tomorrow, to Brussels to face inquisitors and respond to charges that he was lavishly paid off by a wealthy Brit named Aaron Banks, an insurance tycoon who is under investigation by Britain's National Crime Agency. Last month, a TV station revealed that emails, invoices, and documents say that Banks had covered Farage's costs for a £13,000-per-month home in Chelsea, visits to the U.S., a chauffeur-driven car. And that certainly puts him on the defensive. None of the donations were reported to the European Parliament as required. And so Farage is fighting back, saying, I didn't receive any private money for political purposes. The committee would better spend its time investigating the waste of public money by well-known members of the European Parliament. And at a news conference with Theresa May, Trump made a lot of Britons nervous. That's Britons with an O. Because he said that after Brexit is achieved, he's going to negotiate a fabulous trade deal with the United Kingdom that would include privatization of the National Health Service. And the implication is that the grand experience of the United States delivering for-profit health care would somehow be transferred to Britain. And that is just astounding to me. Now, there are complaints, I know, about the National Health Service. People wait in line for medical care in Britain. But every person has a right to it. And that, to me, is more important than some of the issues of how it actually operates. And Trump also took up the issues of his threats to impose tariffs next week on imports to the U.S. from Mexico. And while a couple of timid Republicans, Chuck Grassley of Iowa and John Thune of South Dakota, are trying not to poke the bear, as Bob Corker used to say, but they're really squirrely about these tariffs. They know it's going to hurt farmers in their states. And so they're threatening to, you know, maybe run a vote to try to prevent Trump from using these tariffs. But as we saw with the attempt to steal money to pay for his border wall, I thought Mexico was going to do that. Never mind. That there isn't a two-thirds majority in the Senate to essentially override a veto of their rejection of his ad hoc and arbitrary tariff plans for the nation of Mexico. Asked if the Senate could end up voting to try to block it, he said, my guess is at some point, if they continue down this path and they escalated the tariff, Congress is going to want to be heard from for sure. Oh, that's a quote from John Thune. Sorry. And he goes on to say, I think the broader economic considerations need to be carefully considered when they're moving forward with any kind of new policy like this, blah, 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 and blah. Now, from the Democratic side, they're trying to use the president's desire for approval of the lightly renegotiated NAFTA deal as some sort of leverage to get him to retreat on these arbitrary tariffs on Mexico. And as we've pointed out, these tariffs will be paid by American consumers in order to punish Mexico for the fact that Guatemalans are trying to get to the United States. It is so irrational and just downright stupid. Now, Trump did get some support from a man he appointed to a federal court in Washington, D.C. Judge Trevor McFadden has essentially sided with Trump by refusing to be a referee between Congress and the administration over the attempt to divert money from other parts of the budget to pay for construction of a border fence or barrier along the Mexican frontier. And he has a bizarre argument. He said he is not going to get in the middle of this. The complete independence of the judiciary is peculiarly essential under our constitutional structure. This independence requires the courts take no active resolution whatever in political fights between the other branches. And while the Constitution bestows upon members of the House many powers, it does not grant them standing to hail the executive branch into court, claiming a dilution of Congress's legislative authority. The court declines to take sides in the fight between the House and the President. Well, that's what we call an abdication of responsibility. And so that kind of offsets the decision by a judge here in Oakland, California, who put an injunction in place preventing money from being diverted from the defense budget to build anything along the southern border at this time. There's also a lawsuit that has gotten into a very interesting state. This is the challenge to the administration's plan to insert a question about citizenship into the 2020 census. And as we reported last week, a Republican gerrymandering guru who died last August named Thomas Hofeller left behind computer drives and other evidence that his estranged daughter came into possession of, and she has turned it over to Common Cause. That information shows deep bias among the Republicans who are promoting the idea of a citizenship question in the census. And Judge George Hazel of U.S. District Court, I believe in Washington, he ruled against the question, joining two other federal judges in finding the government had violated administrative law when it added the question last year. But he didn't find enough evidence to support the claims that the government intended to discriminate against immigrants, Latinos, and others. But now this new evidence from Hofeller complicates things in a lot of ways. So there are a total of three rulings against the insertion of the citizenship question. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments on the case in April, and if they go by their normal procedure, they've already voted on the outcome of the case, and they're now writing the opinion to support their decision. It would be extremely rare for the court to reopen the record on a case in which it's heard arguments, but this is very important, game-changing new information. And the plaintiffs are trying to persuade Judge Hazel that they have the missing piece of evidence that prevented him from coming to a conclusion on racial animus. on the part of the officials involved in that decision. More than two dozen groups described as liberal on Tuesday wrote a letter to Nancy Pelosi urging her to begin impeachment proceedings against Trump, saying that her reluctance is resulting in dangerous inaction that enables this racist and xenophobic president. Instead of using your power, Pelosi, you are giving us political excuses for why you shouldn't. Instead of leading, you and your colleagues have asked us to wait. Wait for the Mueller report. Wait for the unredacted Mueller report. Wait for Mueller's testimony about the Mueller report. Wait for more investigations. Wait for bipartisan consensus. Wait for impeachment to poll better. Or wait for the 2020 election. And then trying to kiss ass a little bit at the end of the letter, they said your strong leadership can help move the public narrative not only on impeachment but on the dangers Trump's presidency poses for all Americans. The signers include Credo Action, Free Speech for People, M-Power, Movimiento Cosecca, Democracy for America, Indivisible, Working Families Party, Women's March, and others. And last night, as I usually do, I watched the public television news hour. That's a little surprising because, you know, the Mueller report's been out for a long time now. And they've decided that their audience, their viewers, haven't really focused on it or read it. And so they had two reporters alternating, reading quotes from the Mueller report. Not a single question was raised, no skepticism was in evidence, and of course, no skeptics like Aaron Mattei, Glenn Greenwald, or Peter B. Collins were invited on the news hour to challenge even a word of the gospel according to St. Bob. And what struck me as they were going through this ritual is they included a clip from Mueller, from his first, only, and what he claims is his final statement on his investigation. And it caused me to go back to my files from last week and pull out the verbatim copy, the text, of Bob Mueller's statement. And before I poison your mind, I just want to read this to you verbatim, and then I'll comment. Mueller, quote, "And I will close by reiterating the central allegation of our indictments, that there were multiple systemic efforts to interfere in our election. And that allegation deserves the attention of every American. Thank you, and goodbye." He used the word allegation twice. And I must admit, I glossed over it when I read it a week ago. But even Bob Mueller doesn't conclude that his conclusions are factual and related to Russian interference in the election. And he talked about two parts, hacking and flipping stuff from the DNC and the information campaign designed to dupe Americans into voting for Trump. A measly $46,000 was spent. The public television news hour didn't reference that. And they talked about how the Russians were able to use Facebook to get some people to show up at rallies in the United States, failing to point out that the largest rally I've heard recounted was about 20 people. And so the claim of multiple systemic efforts to interfere in our election and referring to it as an allegation by the man who conducted this investigation over 20 months and was invested with magical powers by a lot of Democrats who supported Hillary Clinton and believe the Russiagate falderal. Mueller calls them allegations. Meanwhile, one of the people that Mueller refused to talk to in his not-so-in-depth investigation, Julian Assange, scored a victory in a Swedish court yesterday as state prosecutors were rebuffed and a district court ruled against their request to formally detain Julian Assange in absentia. Assange's lawyers call it a legal victory, and the hearing followed the reopening last month of a preliminary investigation into sexual misconduct allegations against Assange that has been dropped twice in the past 8 years. And this news account at the World Socialist website accurately says the purpose of the Swedish investigation is to blacken Assange's name and provide an alternate route for his dispatch to a U.S. prison. And as we have discussed, Julian Assange had sex with two different women, consensual sex. When they discovered that each of them had boffed the WikiLeaks founder, they were concerned that they might have been exposed to HIV. They went to the police and asked that Assange take an HIV test, and this is where their request was turned into allegations of sexual misconduct. One of the victims in 2010 sent a text message, "I did not want to put any charges against Julian Assange, and it was the police that made up the charges." An initial preliminary investigation in 2010 found that the evidence didn't disclose any evidence of rape and that there was no crime at all. But the smear is very effective, and it holds for... it's got a shelf life that seems to be... indefinite. I want to commend Kirsten Gillibrand. On Sunday night, she braved many factors. One was that there was an NBA playoff game that was being broadcast, and that's what was on at my house. But she was on Fox News holding a town hall for her presidential campaign. And Gillibrand, while I don't think she will be the person I ever support, I contributed a dollar to her campaign because I'd like to see her get into the presidential debates. I think she brings some important issues and some game. And on Fox News, she went after Fox News for its false coverage of what's called infanticide. She was asked a question by a woman, I believe, from Iowa about, whether she supported partial birth or late-term abortion. And she answered the question by saying that she supports women's reproductive freedom and then ripping into Fox for its false narrative of infanticide. And she says that they spent 6.5 hours talking about phony claims of infanticide, specifically that an abortion doctor would preside over the delivery of a baby and then kill it. And this is the kind of false reporting, spurious and scurrilous, that Fox uses in a very effective manner. And while Chris Wallace said she was impolite to criticize the network on the network, I'm glad that she spoke up, and I commend her for it. Joe Biden today has announced his climate change plan. It's Obama Plus. He would rejoin the Paris Agreement. He would reinstate the executive orders about coal-fired power plants, and he would embrace many of the elements of the Green New Deal. But Joe Biden is silent about fracking, and many environmentalists have pointed that out in critiquing his plan. And I know a lot of people who think Joe Biden is the answer for the Democrats in 2020. He's got name ID, he's got a rosy connection to Obama. He's not Bernie Sanders because Bernie scares too many people with the socialism. He's a solid corporate Democrat who supports capitalism. But there's a new study, and Keith A. Spencer wrote it up at Salon.com today. There's a link in the show file for my podcast if you'd like to read it. And he cites the French economist Thomas Piketty, who first warned Democrats in 2018 and has now written a new paper based on deep, deep, detailed data analysis, showing essentially that if Democrats run a moderate like Joe Biden or Kamala Harris, they're going to lose. And he bases it on the issue of rising inequality, the lack of a Democratic response to it, and the rise of populism. And he fundamentally concludes that if you run a moderate like Biden or Harris, a lot of people simply won't vote. They will not be motivated to show up and exercise their right. And I would add to this, just on the political level, that if Biden runs, Trump will make the campaign about Barack Obama. He'll hint at the birther stuff. He'll talk about Obamacare. Might even bring up the bungles in Syria and Libya. So I encourage you to read this article about Piketty because I think it makes some very important points. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the PBC Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Don Cisney, Jeff Lipinski, Tom Burkhart just renewed his annual subscription. Thank you, Tom. And Jim McHugh kicks in $5 a month. Could you do it? Well, why don't you? Just visit peterbcollins.com. Click on menu, click on become a subscriber. You'll land on the sign-up page and boom. You can choose the level of support that's comfortable for you. And if you don't like PayPal, you can always communicate with me in the U.S. mail. I am at Box 150, 660, San Rafael, California, 94915. And yes, I have bonus books for people who take out a new annual subscription and cough up a mailing address in the continental U.S. I look at the Guardian newspaper out of London every day. I'm skeptical of its coverage of Russiagate, the Skripal poisoning, Venezuela, many issues. But they impress me with remarkable enterprise journalism here in the United States. And here's a fresh example. They have just published the first installment in a year-long series exploring how my community, the Bay Area, is defying expectations and gun violence has dropped sharply. Over the last 10 years, the overall gun homicide rate has dropped 30%, and they examined the data across more than 100 cities in this region. Gun homicide rates fell across all racial groups. The decrease was largest for African Americans. This came as criminal justice reforms reduced the number of people incarcerated. And it came as cities like Oakland and Richmond invested tens of millions of dollars in public health approaches to gun violence prevention. And three cities that are undergoing intense gentrification saw the biggest drops in gun homicides. So it's very encouraging, and I've linked to this report. It is rich in animated graphics. And it's best if you look at it on The Guardian's website to get the full impact. Remember John Boehner, the lame Republican speaker who resigned and handed it off to Paul Ryan, who then resigned because neither of them wanted to work with Trump? Well, John Boehner has traded his trademark glass of Merlot for marijuana. And he has signed up to be a lobbyist for Acreage Holdings, a marijuana investment firm that has just merged with Canopy Growth, a Canadian company that's the biggest cannabis operator in the world. The deal is worth $3 billion, and it could earn John Boehner $20 million. That's his potential payout. And before you think I'm just picking on Boehner, the other former electeds who are now lobbying for weed include Tom Daschle of South Dakota, Democratic leader in the Senate, former Representative Dana Rohrabacher, the surfing Putin lover from Southern California, Joe Crowley, the powerhouse Democrat defeated by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and there are others. Last week, among others, I reported unproven claims that the lead negotiator for North Korea in the talks with the U.S. has been disappeared. There are various accounts that he may have been executed, that he was in a labor camp. His name is Kim Jong-chol. And I believe that I offered appropriate caveats in my reports on these reports. But if I didn't, I apologize. Because Kim Jong-chol was spotted at a concert in Pyongyang, sitting five seats away from the powerful Kim Jong-un. And I want to recommend at Mint Press News today a piece by Alexander Rubinstein, who points out the false reports that have come from South Korea about what's going on in North Korea in the past. Like in 2016, a North Korean defector claimed that a military officer had been executed The media reported it uncritically, and then this guy got promoted to the position of chief of general staff. In 2013, a famous singer in North Korea was reported to have been executed in a hail of machine gun fire while members of her orchestra looked on. But she is still singing her heart out with her all-girl pop band. And in 2010, South Korean media reported that a soccer coach had been executed in North Korea, and then a reporter was shocked when she ran into him at the Pyongyang airport a few weeks after his death was announced. I want to recommend a new analysis by Gareth Porter, published at Salon today. And he goes further in challenging the unproven claims from John Bolton and other administration sources that Iran is responsible for recent minor incidents related to oil tankers and trying to blame them for a rocket that came near the Green Zone in Baghdad. And Porter zeroes in on a briefing from Vice Admiral Michael Gilday, a director of the Joint Staff, who couldn't summon a single fact to back up his claims. In a prepared statement that he read, he said, "In the recent past, Iranian leaders have publicly threatened to close the Strait of Hormuz. They've backed up those threats with actions, posturing their forces in an effort to intimidate the movement of international trade and global energy sources." But when reporters asked him for any evidence, all he could do was repeat his talking points. And Gareth Porter says the implications of this arrangement are profound and dangerous. It means that intelligence analysts have been removed from the process, allowing John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, to determine the validity of the intelligence warnings on Iran coming from the Israelis. That same stovepiping gives Bolton, who's long had a reputation for cynically twisting intelligence to advance his own political aims, a crucial source of power over intelligence on Iran. I also want to note that Whitney Webb at Mint Press News weighs in on some of the same issues about Iran and the attempts at regime change in Venezuela, opening with the quote of Rachel Maddow, who was critical of Trump for taking a phone call from Putin and then appearing to back off from the confrontation and threat of a possible military intervention in Venezuela. And Webb writes, "Corporate media voices remain silent on the Trump administration's other regime change project in Iran, despite the fact that the Putin-led Russian government is set to be the biggest winner as tensions between the U.S. and the Islamic Republic boil over and threaten to send the Middle East into a fresh bout of destruction and chaos." And she argues that Russia would be the winner, as oil prices would likely go up, and it would be both cashed up and more influential if there is a takedown or an attempted takedown of Iran. She writes, "In this case, Russia is counting on Israel's influence on the Trump administration to ensure that if Iranian forces vacate Syria, it will be Russia that will dominate the country post-conflict." So I think there's some very interesting analysis here, and I encourage you to follow the link in my show file and read it at Mint Press News. I've also got a link to this story at the Gray Zone Project under the byline of Ben Norton, showing that the U.S. has sent TOW anti-tank missiles, spelled T-O-W, to Turkey to be used by Turkish-backed Islamist rebels in Syria, where the battle for Idlib rages on. I mean, it's way into overtime. And Trump has acted like the U.S. is just completely out of the war zone. We have no more interest there. But we are feeding weapons to the Turks, who then hand them off to the allegedly moderate Free Syrian Army. And the conflict continues with hundreds of thousands of people being displaced, and the carnage continues to mount. Last Tuesday, before the Israeli government collapsed and Netanyahu was forced to accept a second round of elections to hold on to power, Mike Pompeo told the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations in New York that the Crown Prince Jared peace plan for the Middle East may be unexecutable. It might not gain traction. And that many people will perceive it as, well, here's his quote. I get why people think this is going to be a deal that only the Israelis could love. I understand the perception of that. And meanwhile, because of the political uncertainty in Israel, Jared Kushner has been forced to delay once again the revelations of his the political side of his peace plan. He is still planning to talk about the economic side, which is just another, you know, corporate stimulus plan. But one of the things that Kushner said really stirred up anger among Palestinians. He was asked in an interview whether he believed Palestinians are capable of governing themselves without Israeli influence. And he said, that's a very good question. That's one that we'll have to see. The hope is that they, over time, will become capable of governing. And he said, the Palestinians need to have a fair judicial system, freedom of the press, freedom of expression, tolerance for all religions. Yeah, just like Israel. And Mike Pompeo is now ready to sit down and talk with the Iranians. We pulled out of the six or seven nation nuclear deal. We have slapped them with nasty sanctions. And now Pompeo expects them to come running to talk to him. And it's very clear Iran has no intention of doing so. And Pompeo and Kushner are both going to be leaving London to fly to Montreux, Switzerland on Lake Geneva for the 67th Bilderberg meeting. And this is this murky organization where they meet. It's all these rich fuckers from all over the world, and they make schemes and dreams. But the rule is that you're not allowed to reveal exactly what was said or who said it. And the curious guest list includes David Petraeus, the disgraced former military leader of the United States, former Google boss Eric Schmidt, Henry Kissinger, who isn't dead yet, and Stacey Abrams, the woman who ran for governor of Georgia last year. Stacey, what are you doing at Bilderberg? Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast, my ranting and raving all the way to the bitter end here. You're free to share it all over the place. And I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you.